This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Saturday, June 24, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. The North Korean hermit kingdom has improved somewhat, at least for elites in the country. And yet many things have stayed the same, as evidenced by the death of a comatose student who had been sentenced to decades of hard labor. Cato senior fellow Doug Bandow recently returned from Pyongyang. We spoke yesterday. You were in Pyongyang when Otto Warmbier, and I'm sure I'm getting the name wrong, was released. He was already in a coma, we found out, after he was released. Was there any sense of that in Pyongyang at the time?
No, I found out about his release via the internet, actually, which foreigners can access while they're in Pyongyang. I'd planned on mentioning to the people I talked to that it did not do their image any good by holding him. And, you know, it's tragic, the situation that he came out of. I asked them if this was their offering, in a sense, to the Trump administration to try to get, say, talks going. And they were vehement that this was humanitarian. It had no political purpose.
And we may be able to take them on their word for that, because I doubt that the medical facilities in Pyongyang were equipped to deal with someone who was in a coma.
Well, they certainly would have, you know, a good hospital for the leadership. Their problem is, what I suspect they figured out was that if he was declining, to have him die there would be an extraordinary embarrassment. So this is something I suspect at some point somebody noticed and said, we've got to get him back to the U.S., you know, in almost any way possible, which led to some talks, led to their revelation. They told the U.S. of his condition, and then the U.S. pushed very hard to get him, and the North Koreans let him go immediately.
And that makes sense, I suppose, for the United States. They don't want the necessary backlash that already has occurred. Would it be that much more striking if Mr. Warmbier had died in Pyongyang?
Well, I think that's right. And I think they certainly didn't know how close to death he was. I don't know even if the North Koreans knew that. But their hope was to get him back to U.S. medical facilities, would offer better treatment, and hopefully at least some recovery for him, which, you know, turned out was not the case. But they could have had that hope certainly going into it, getting back to America as quickly as possible.
What duty does the United States have to be more harsh with North Korea, given the fact that this young man was taken for a fairly minor crime, sentenced to hard labor, went into a coma, perhaps due to mistreatment while there, and then died upon his return to the United States? What duty does the U.S. have to, in the words of a lot of pundits, act?
Well, I think there are two separate issues here. You know, the first is, look, I went to North Korea and I wasn't concerned. They'd invited me. This is a trip they wanted to work out, and I knew what not to do. But I think that, you know, if you go to North Korea, you live by their rules. And everyone who's gone there who's been arrested has, in the North Koreans' eyes, done something, left a Bible out, evangelized, worked with refugees. So I think, you know, the first point is, if you go to a country like that, you know the character of the regime, you really have a responsibility not to do something, just recognizing the dangers there. So I don't think the U.S. directly has a right, say, to intervene because you've done that. On the other hand, it makes a lot of sense for the U.S. to try to help get you out, you know, to look for options, to, you know, find ways to work to get its citizens home. I think that's, you know, quite reasonable for the U.S. government to do. The second issue is whether there was mistreatment. And as far as we can tell, I mean, at the moment, the evidence is there's nothing, that we just don't know what happened other than the lack of oxygen. You know, there's no evidence from medical exams, for example, that he'd been beaten. Some of the other, you know, others had been treated rather badly, the ones who'd been involved, for example, with refugees. You know, mistreatment, I think, would actually, you know, suggest the U.S. should try to do something more. That is, it's one thing to arrest somebody under laws that we would find utterly offensive. I mean, the notion you'd be sentenced to 15 years of hard labor for stealing a poster is obviously ridiculous. On the other hand, you know, if you're out there beating prisoners, if you're treating them that way, then I think that is really, in some sense, an offense against the U.S. But there's not much the U.S. can do. We're already sanctioning them because of their nuclear program. You know, we've sent carriers off their shores. We've sent B-2 bombers overhead. You know, the tragedy here is we don't have much leverage, and we have very little leverage in terms of getting back. There are three more Americans who are still incarcerated over there.
You visited Pyongyang 25 years ago. What were some of the most striking things about the regime, about the people, about the basic creature comforts that people had access to in Pyongyang then?
Well, there's one very important sense in which it hasn't changed, which is this is a regime of one. Now, there is one person in that country. When I visited 25 years ago, it was the great leader Kim Il-sung, who was a couple of years later succeeded by his son, the dear leader Kim Jong-il. Today we have in power the supreme leader, Kim Jong-un. Everything revolves around this leader. You know, so everyone you talk to, you know, pictures, portraits, statues, you know, and that hasn't changed. This is a system built around one person. Everyone revolves around that person. People in the capital wear buttons that have, you know, the picture of one or another of these people there. And that's the same. And it's utterly creepy. I mean, you talk to people and, you know, 50 or 60 times I heard the same phrase, under the wise leadership of the supreme leader. And it turns out the supreme leader helps design buildings. He designs backpacks that go on that children wear. You know, he helps, you know, he sends guidance in terms of construction. He's everywhere doing everything. That really is the same. It's, you know, there's a slightly difference in what the portraits are and the emphasis, but Pyongyang has not changed. On the other hand, this is a capital that has a lot more money. There are a lot of nice new buildings, and they're generally nice new buildings. There are private automobiles. I mean, you actually need stoplights today. When I was there 25 years ago, I went running every day. You really didn't have to worry. I mean, you should take a look, but the likelihood of being hit by a car was very small. People have cell phones today. Now, they're not supposed to be able to use them to call out, you know, internationally, but they have them, including my handlers, the folks who spent time with me. Women dress very nicely. Back then, men and women both dressed very plainly. Today, women dress in high heels, you know, very nice skirts and blouses, colors, I mean, much brighter in terms of the dress. You know, that's a pretty substantial change. I also saw more goods in stores, people buying food, you know, from kind of corner bakeries. I mean, it's obvious that there has been a change economically. Now, that isn't reflected so much in the countryside. I talked to people who got out there. I didn't have time to do so. Countryside remains quite poor, you know, some change, but not nearly as much. But certainly the capital, kind of where the elite live, it is a different place.
So let's be clear about the distinctions here. The people who live in the capital in Pyongyang are elites. They are people who are much closer to the government, the actual functioning of the government, and they are trusted.
That's right. The regime has, they call it the Songbon system. They have a system of classification. You know, and I mean, and broadly speaking, you're viewed as loyal, you're kind of in the middle, you're disloyal. If you're living in Pyongyang, you're viewed as being loyal. I mean, this is, you have to have permission to live there. You have the best creature comforts. You have the best access to the best goods. I mean, you want to live in Pyongyang. So that is clearly the place to be. It's a couple million people that it's very different. And then you move out into the countryside, you kind of move down the social scale. You know, and where if you're in the bottom category, you're the person who starves when they don't have any food. Countryside is much poorer. The more distant, the countryside, the more likely they are to put people who are not trusted, who are viewed as enemies of the state.
With respect to these recent tests of missiles, both nuclear missiles and just delivery systems, what do you make of the situation now? North Korea, of course, had a failed nuclear test, which is odd that that would be presented to the public as an event.
Well, this is, you know, the military side is kind of central to the North Korean state, where Kim Jong-il, the father of the current ruler, talked about a military first policy. Your resources were going to go there very heavily, you know, nukes as well as your rockets, as well as conventional forces. They've done some upgrading of conventional forces as well. The the current leader has followed a policy of both. He wants nukes as well as he wants better economic conditions, but he's pushed very hard for both missiles and nukes. And, you know, talking with them, there are a number of reasons why they want these. I mean, it gives, you know, nobody would pay attention to this country if it didn't have nuclear weapons. It's a very poor country, you know, isolated, not very important in international affairs. It wants nuclear weapons. It dominates international headlines. You know, it's a tool of extortion. It has, you know, atomic weapons have domestic uses, that is kind of binding the military to the regime, rewarding the military with a big, fancy, expensive weapon. But also it's self-defense. And I tell people, you know, even paranoids have enemies. You know, the North Koreans in the, you know, it's hard to separate, of course, how much is propaganda, how much is real. Nevertheless, the case they make is a rational one, which is simply, you know, the U.S. has threatened us with nuclear weapons for 60 years. The U.S. is here. The U.S. has, you know, threatened to be involved in another war. The U.S. engages in regime change in other countries, even in Libya, where there, you know, an agreement was made to, you know, give up Libya's nuclear weapons and rocket program, and look what happened to this guy. So they view this as a matter of deterrence. And the way they put it is, well, it's all because of America's hostile policy. You know, it's nuclear threats, it's military threats. And I think that is certainly part of it, that this is a regime that is desperate to survive. And it recognizes, they won't admit it, but it recognizes it is extraordinarily far behind not just America, but South Korea in terms of economic capabilities, technology, you know, all the kind of normal attributes of national power. The one area they are kind of clearly superior is the issue of nuclear weapons and missiles.
You know, years ago, for the first time when in discussing Robert Mugabe a long time ago, someone I was talking to said that he was, in essence, captured in a way, that he was captured by the military, that if he didn't provide the military with adequate sustenance, and certainly provided that sustenance to the military first, that he would be in trouble. Is there anything like that going on with Kim Jong-un in North Korea?
Well, I think in a broad sense, yes. That is, you know, the party officials recognize the one force within the society that could threaten them is the military. You know, the one place you could move and find coercive power to change the power structure, it would be the military. And because of that, they handle things, you know, they're very tough. I mean, the current leader, the supreme leader, as they call him, has gone through a lot of military officials. He's moved people around. He's executed both generals and a defense minister. And what you sense is that he understands the dangers. You don't let anybody hold any particular position too long, and you monitor them very carefully. I mean, their Secret Service is monitoring conversations, actions, activities. One other thing which the North does is they don't hold, you know, special forces, you know, or maneuvers with special forces and normal military. They keep them separate. You know, what they try to do is make sure there's always a force they could call upon. They try to, you know, make it hard for coordination. This isn't good for military effectiveness, but it's very important for political survival. So I think that Kim Jong-un is quite aware of the dangers here. That, however, so far at least, he seems to have taken the steps that are necessary, you know, to keep the military under control. At the same time, he's given them a lot of benefits. So you do both sides. You provide them with benefits, both material benefits personally, as well as weapons and things that they want for the military. And you also monitor them. You take out anybody who you're afraid of.
Doug Bandow is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play. And follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.